Okay. We're up to chemical reactions part two, the continuation of last week's cheer. I didn't bring the heating element once again to do another demonstration because I actually taught a class and used it for that over at York today. So at this point, my heating elements are all burned out. You'll just have to remember it from last week or go out and spring for the $10 and get yourself a labriot meal and try it yourself. But to review from last time, we began by explaining that for last week and this, we're discussing the issue of employing chemical reactions to cook on Shabbos. Part of this, and that's what we're going to get to today, I hope, is a broader discussion about triggering a chemical reaction on Shabbos in general. There are quite a few technologies that are in use today, particularly military applications, that rely on the use of chemical reactions. One example is the light stick we talked about last week, where you have a tube with two compartments inside. You snap the tube, the contents of the compartments combine, creating a reaction which produces light for, of course, a limited period of time. Desalination plants in Israel rely on it, and as we started talking about last week, self-heating meals used in the military. So last week we demonstrated the way they work. We noted it's magnesium and iron that are combined with salt water, and it's really the sodium, I think that's actually the key, the sodium chloride. And the way that results in a chemical reaction which produces heat. We talked about the origins of the technology, noted that it existed back in the Gemara as well. We noted that technically fire is a chemical reaction too. It's called oxidation. And we discussed our primary question, which was, if I heat food using this means, is that called bishul or not? Is that the type of cooking that's prohibited on Shabbos? And what we noted at that point is that it's certainly not the equivalent of cooking with a flame. We noted that cooking with the sun, cooking from the direct rays of the sun, is actually permitted on Shabbos, and suggested that maybe this is more similar to cooking with the direct rays of the sun. It was based on a comment from Rashi. Rashi said the difference between cooking with the sun and cooking with a flame is that when you cook with a flame, that's the derech bishul, that's the way of cooking. Cooking with the sun is not. And then we had to understand why Rashi differentiates. What exactly does he mean? And one explanation was because when they cooked in the Mishkan, they used a flame. Another explanation, though, was that normal cooking is with a flame. The difference between those two explanations is that if you're going to tell me it's based on what was done in the Mishkan, they weren't using these reactions to cook in the Mishkan, and therefore this will indeed be permitted on Shabbos. On the other hand, if the issue is what's the normal way to cook, then my answer may well be that at some point or in some environment, this may be the normal way to cook, such as in the military where the MREs, the meals ready to eat, are in fact heated with that sort of a reaction. But that's all last week. I just wanted to give it a brief rundown. Now we move on to new issues. The outline that I gave out last week is somewhat out of order on this segment. It's still pretty useful, and the sources are still useful, but I'm not going to quite follow the order that I had in the original outline. Anyone not have a sheet, first of all? Sheets are there? Okay. What we theoretically are up to on the sheet is creating a chemical reaction prohibited, and that's actually where I am going to start. Is there anything wrong with generating a chemical reaction intentionally on Shabbos? So, for example, pouring the water on this magnesium iron combination. What would you think? Any reason to assume that it's not allowed? Having nothing to do with cooking now, just in general, generating a reaction. Any reason to think that you couldn't do it on Shabbos? Yes. Why would it be makeh b'patish? Makeh b'patish means striking something with a hammer. We are going to come back to makeh b'patish, but I want to hear why makeh b'patish should be relevant. What am I changing? The magnesium and iron are still magnesium and iron afterwards.
It's volatile. It's
right. That's true. That's true. It's not useful in that way anymore. The oxidation process is complete. Yes. Changing its form? In what sense am I changing its form? You wouldn't be able to tell the difference by looking at it.
Well, subsequent to the reaction, it has a different form.
Right. And that goes back a little bit to the idea of altering it via the reaction, in the sense that it won't react again. But there really is nothing visible about it. See, creating a chemical reaction in and of itself sounds like it should be something you can't do on Shabbos. Like, if I were to ask my kids with a rudimentary understanding of the laws of Shabbos, can you do this on Shabbos? They would say, no way. And I would say, why? And they would say, because it looks too cool to be allowed on Shabbos. The idea that you can pour this on it, it's going to generate steam, no way. But the truth is, maybe it is permitted. Yes. Correct. Right, but remember, as we said last week, that we really focus on the visual within halacha. We place great emphasis on that, right? That was when we explained the distinction between this chemical reaction and the oxidation that goes on in fire, and we noted they're both chemical reactions, and the only difference is one has this big show with a lot of light associated with it, the emission of the flames, and this, you know, this chemical reaction doesn't. I'm not so sure that the fact that I've changed it on a molecular level is really going to be halachically significant. Yes? Creation. Maybe. I'll tell you what, we're going to come back to it, but it's creation in an odd way. Creation not in terms of the reaction as much as it's going to be creation in terms of, well, we'll get to it. Creation is going to come into, is going to come into play. In terms of creating a reaction itself, that issue was debated and discussed 150 years ago by Poskim, who were dealing with the innovation of being able to create some kind of seltzer on Shabbos. What they would do is they would take water that was essentially a sour or even bitter water. I'm thinking it was something like tonic water that people have nowadays, and they would carbonate it. And that would convert it into a usable drink. And so various halachic authorities were asked, can you do that on Shabbos? Is there anything wrong with doing this on Shabbos? And the authorities there said, well, it is a chemical reaction. They would introduce a powder, and the powder would react with the water, and that would generate the bubbles. So the question was, is that in and of itself a problem on Shabbos? And the answer appears to be no. The answer appears to be that in terms of a reaction itself, you can create reactions all Shabbos long. Rav Nachum Rabinovitz wrote an article in Tchumen, which is a fantastic, fantastic journal on halacha and technology. The latest stuff from Tzomet forever appears in Tchumen, but it's much broader than that. In his article, he was dealing with the stick light issue that I mentioned, the lights that you snap in order to ignite them. And he says, look, in the Gemara we talk about dyeing something, coloring something on Shabbos. And we say you can't do it because it is, what's it called? Soveya, coloring something, right? I'm not allowed to color something on Shabbos. No one in the Gemara, in the discussion of coloring things, discusses the fact that the dye might react on a chemical level with the material that you are actually coloring. No one mentions that as an issue. Ditto for all sorts of other malachos, which we only define in the Gemara, in terms of the malacha, we don't define it in terms of a reaction. No one says you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos because that's a chemical reaction. No one says you can't light a fire on Shabbos because it's a chemical reaction. They all give other explanations. No one mentions this chemical change. Granted that the scientific terminology that we use today, we call it a chemical reaction, wouldn't necessarily have applied, but no one is even trying to assign it some kind of meaning as separate from a physical reaction, separate from a physical change. We know that, and we said this last week, I'm allowed to cook in the sun. If the sun is shining down through my skylight into my kitchen, and it gets hot enough to cook, and I put food there, that's great. The food's permitted to me on Shabbos. There is no issue. Why? Chemical reactions are involved in cooking. And chemical reactions were recognized, I'll give you one example, the issue of mitzareif, of tempering metal by heating it up and then cooling it off. So they discussed that in terms of its impermissibility on Shabbos, and they recognize that that's a change that's not reversible. It's a change that's more than just a physical one, but that something is occurring on a very on a minute level. And yet they don't say, well, this is an issue of creating a chemical reaction. It seems that creating a chemical reaction was not a problem in the Gemara itself, in and of itself. So that's the chemical reaction issue. Now, though, we move on to the discussion of makeh bepatish. Sorry?
Do you use a magnifying glass other than the fact that it's...
We'll come back to it. Great question. We'll come back to it. And indeed, if you're allowed to use it, then it's not muktzah at all. And magnifying glasses are not, as far as I understand, muktzah. I mean, people use them to read. the so I wouldn't consider it. There you go. He's got two of them. But the discussion about using the magnifying glass to focus the rays of light is one I hope to come back to towards the end. So remind me if I don't, but I'm pretty sure I will accept it in my notes.
What would the descending of the
results? Right, so we're going to come back to it here. So we'll see. But another possible concern is the concern for Makeh B'Patish, which was mentioned before, but in a little bit of a different way. Makeh B'Patish, as I mentioned, means literally striking something with a hammer. But take a look, please, at your source sheet. We are now on the third side. Source number 10, it's a Gemara in Shabbos. Kol midi di'is bei gemar malacha chayav mishum Makeh B'Patish. Anything, any action which involves completion of malacha. I was performing malacha on something to convert it from state A to state B. Now I finish that. That is Makeh B'Patish. That's Rashi, that's the Gemara's definition. The Yerushalmi gives a little bit of a different definition. It's almost comical reading the Yerushalmi's definition. It says, basically, when there's an action and we can identify the av, the source malacha, to prohibit it, then we mention the av. If we can't find an av, then we just call it a told av Makeh B'Patish. It's sort of a bin in which we're just going to put all the other malachas that we know you shouldn't be able to do, but we can't figure out why. We don't actually paskin like that Yerushalmi, but it's a funny definition, so I bring it. But the Bavli, the Gemara here, says anytime you are completing something, you are making something usable, that's Makeh B'Patish. And so, some of the poskim ask here regarding our chemical reaction and also regarding the seltzer making, whether it's not Makeh B'Patish, and that I'm taking something that was not usable, specifically the food, that had been heated and then made into this congealed form that you'll find if you open up the package without eating it. You're taking that food and heating it up to make it usable. In the case of the seltzer, you're taking water that really wasn't drinkable as water. It wasn't potable water. By carbonating it, you're turning it into a beverage. Maybe that counts as Makeh B'Patish. That's one of the arguments that was brought regarding seltzer, and it's relevant for our discussion now as well. Rameir Auerbach, writing in the mid-19th century in Yerushalayim, indeed said, yes, it's Makeh B'Patish. That was his ruling. So is that it then? Beginning, middle, and end? We've resolved the problem. You're not allowed to do it? Not necessarily. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, writing in the first part of the 20th century in his Har Tzvi, said, I don't believe that this is Makeh B'Patish for three reasons. Number one, as the Gemara defines Makeh B'Patish, you are completing something, right? I had wood. The wood wasn't usable. I hammered it together and made a chair. Right? The chair will last. Well, no. Sorry. Craig hammered together wood and made a chair out of it. Now it'll last. If I hammer the wood together to make a chair, don't try it. Don't sit on it. It won't necessarily last. Somebody else did it. That's Makeh B'Patish, right? You made it usable. Right? And in an enduring way. Whereas with the seltzer, you know what happens if you leave the bottle open? Oy seltzer, right? The gas is gonna exit and it's over. And ditto here regarding our reaction, the heat is gonna dissipate. Right? Yes, it's true, the food is usable right now and it's nice and hot right now, but the heat's gonna go away. This is not an enduring change. It's not an enduring malacha. That's number one. Number two, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank argues, Makeh B'Patish is like a construction thing, as noted from the terminology itself. Hitting something with a hammer, right, that's construction. You don't do that with food. Right? Makeh B'Patish is not relevant, he argued, to food at all. Now, in fact, that point that he makes is somewhat debatable. If you take a look on your sheets, at source number 11, you find a passage from the Talmud Yerushalmi regarding crushing garlic. The Yerushalmi is analyzing just exactly what you would violate and how many things you would violate if you crush garlic on Shabbos. And this is what it says. Hahein deshachak tuma, a person who crushes garlic, kad mafrach bereishaya mishum dash, when he first crumbles the head, he is liable for disha. Disha is a term we use for threshing. Then I ellipsized it in the English, but if you look in the Aramaic, you'll see when he starts to separate out the skins from everything else, that's borer, selection, another violation. When he grinds it up in the mortar and pestle, he is liable for tochen, grinding, and kadyor, mashkin, then he puts water on it, and then grinds it, mishum dash, there's another issue of threshing involved, which I think, I wonder if that shouldn't say lush. Wonder about that. All right. And then Gomar Malachtan, when he finishes the process of grinding up the garlic, he is in violation of Mishum Makem Bepatish, striking with a hammer. Well, Yotzi Pesach Frank, how can you tell me that Makem Bepatish doesn't apply to food? It's black on white, right? That it does apply to food. Where is he coming from? So the truth is that the Mishnah Berurah, writing in the Beer Halacha, suggested that Makem Bepatish really does not apply to food ordinarily, despite this Yerushalmi. It may actually be a debate between the Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli. Because in the Bavli, we have a Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Tes, page 39, where the Gemara talks about cooking an egg on Shabbos on a surface of hot lime. Okay? Leave aside why you would want to do that. But cooking an egg on hot lime on Shabbos, it notes that it would be an Isser D'Rabbanan, a rabbinic prohibition, depending on how the lime was heated. However, no one says it's Makem Bepatish. You're taking a raw egg and making it usable. And no one says that it's Makem Bepatish. Again, we got into this because we said maybe heating up the food is Makem Bepatish. And Ratzi Pesach Frank said it's not, because Makem Bepatish doesn't apply to food. Well, there's a proof. From the fact that when you cook the egg, no one says it's Makem Bepatish. So Makem Bepatish does not, according to the Bavli, does not apply to food. And when you have a debate between Bavli and Yerushalmi, the rule is we follow Bavli. So therefore, we could retain Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's point that Makem Bepatish generally doesn't apply to food. And then a third reason to be lenient. The Makem Bepatish, literally, striking something with a hammer, means I have my raw materials, I connect them in the case of building a chair, and with my action, the work is complete. There's nothing left to do, nothing has to happen on its own. My action completes everything. That's not the case in our discussion, right? It's not the case in the discussion regarding the seltzer, where the reaction that you trigger by dropping this into the water isn't what actually makes the water drinkable. There's still a result, that there's an intervening step, the reaction itself. So too here, when I start the reaction by exposing the magnesium and iron to salt water, that isn't what heats the food. There's an intervening step, the releasing of the heat via the reaction. Why does that intervening step matter? Because of a Gemara in Shabbos. If you take a look at source number 12, they talk about making a barrel out of clay and putting it in an oven. And as Rashi there explains, regarding a barrel, you see that? There is no issue of Makem Bepatish, no problem of Makem Bepatish, for its work is completed on its own in the oven. The barrel becomes complete through the heating that goes on in the oven. All I did was put it into the oven. That's enough of a disconnect that I am not considered to be liable for Makem Bepatish. Makem Bepatish is a narrow malacha. It's not as broad as we first articulated it, right? When we said Makem Bepatish means you completed something, you made it usable. No. Makem Bepatish now means I performed a specific act on a non-food item to create an enduring change which was immediate. That's how we've now narrowed down the definition of Makem Bepatish. Striking something with a hammer will now not apply then in the food case. So I can check that off on my list and say, yes, we viewed Makem Bepatish, we discussed it, and we really don't think it's necessarily an issue. That's certainly the stance of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank writing on the seltzer issue. So far, so good? I'm throwing out a lot of sources. I hope it's not too much in that regard. I hope that having it on the sheet helps. One more concern that we have to address, and I left this one for last because, first of all, it's a derabanan, as opposed to the others which we dealt with, which were deoraisa potentially deoraisa issues, and also because it's the most confusing of the bunch. So if you're not confused yet, yoshu koach, good luck. And this is the issue of molid, and in particular molid chom, and it goes back to your point about creating something new. That's where the term that I think you were looking for is, in fact, the term molid. Take a look, please, at source number 13, the classic case of Sechufei Kasa Ashiroi. There was a practice of taking a cup and filling it with fragrant items, spices and the like, and then rubbing it along material in order to put the fragrance into the material itself, to invest the fragrance into the material. If you go back to the times of the Gemara, they were very into fragrance overall. There was a practice called the Mugmar practice, where they would bring out heating element, coals or something, and they would put spices on the coals, and then they would drape clothing over it. Or they would use it to scent a room, perhaps during dessert. They would bring out the mugmar. And this was it was considered to be a special treat. Royalty did it. So here you're talking about wanting to scent clothing and doing it by pressing a cup filled with spices of some kind on the material. And we're told pressing a cup on silks on Yom Tov, note that this is Yom Tov we're talking about here, is prohibited. Why? Because one creates a scent. You are creating something new. What is it? It is reyach. Lest one think this only applies to creating a scent, take a look at source number 14. Ein motzien es ha'ur lo min ha'etzim v'lo min ha'avanim v'lo min ha'afar. You're not allowed to produce fire using wood, using stones, using dirt, v'lo min ha'ra'afim, using coals, v'lo min ha'mayim, or using water. Parenthetically, how do you create fire using water? Goes back to the question that was asked before, and towards the beginning. Sorry? Oh, well, that's true. Yes, if you add some salt and then you pour it over, yeah. How else?
Using it as a lens,
exactly, to focus the light. So he says, I'm not allowed to do that. There's nothing wrong inherently with focusing light. The problem is producing fire by focusing the light. So the statement here is, I'm not allowed to do it, and the issue here is, I am a molid esh. I am producing fire. And so I'm not, that's prohibited on Shabbos. So based on that, this concept of molid, and in fact that's brought as halacha in the Rambam, maybe I would argue that this reaction is molid chom, creates heat. And just like creating a scent in a garment is a problem, and just like creating sparks is a problem, creating heat from this reaction may also be considered a problem. That's a potential issue here. And indeed, it came up in that old seltzer debate as well. The question of whether you are molded, you are creating something new, in that case, didn't involve heat. It involved creating this new carbonated product. And that was their question. Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin was the Rav in Yerushalayim 100 years ago, and he prohibited and it was understood that he had prohibited because he believed this is a chemical change and it's not one you could easily reverse. Therefore, it's what he called molid davar chadash. You are creating something brand new by going through this reaction. The Beis Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Shmelkis, writing in 1895, said the same thing on a different front. Perhaps one of the most famous tshuvos from the end of the 19th century was this tshuva, this responsum from the Beis Yitzchak. It's his telephone responsum, in which he wrote, really, the first authoritative tshuva to prohibit the use of electricity on Shabbos. Until his time, most of those who wrote about electricity didn't really understand what they were talking about. So, for example, there's one classic tshuva in which the authority who's writing talks about the electrons lurking in the wall inside the wires and waiting for you to complete the circuits that they can come out, which isn't the physics of it, but frankly, in those days, there weren't too many people who actually understood the physics of what was going on when you complete an electrical circuit. It's not surprising that that was so. But Rav Yitzchak Shmelkis writes his tshuva was about using a telephone on Shabbos. He says you would not be allowed to complete a circuit because, he says, you are molid. You're creating this electrical flow when you complete the circuit. And in the same tshuva, he discusses soda water and says, and that's molid too. That's a problem of molid also. You're creating something new there. They discuss as well a ruling from several centuries ago regarding making vinegar. Let's say I take wine and I pour it into vinegar. I use the vinegar as a starter in order to create more vinegar, to ferment the wine further. And we say you're not allowed to do that either, because that's molid. You are triggering this process of generating new vinegar. So that's the reason why I would argue that this is a molid issue. It's an issue of creating something new. However, there's an argument against, for three reasons. Number one, the argument of the Maharsham. The Maharsham, regarding the soda water, this big soda water debate. Did you ever know before coming here that there was a debate about making the soda water? It was so big, it raged back and forth. The Maharsham first ruled you're not allowed to make soda water. That was his initial ruling. He said you can't do it. Then, there's a footnote in the edition that I have of the Maharsham's Chuvos. They printed up on the Bar Ilan CD-ROM, the latest version. They have a footnote in which he recants. He says, Rabbanim have written to me and explained to me that in fact this should be permitted, and he gives you reasons to defeat each of his initial prohibiting arguments. And regarding the issue of molid, he says, you know what? I don't think it's a problem. Take a look at the Taz, he says. The Taz writes, I didn't bring it here on the sheet, but the Taz wrote that one would be allowed to make salt water on Shabbos. Sorry? He says, you'd be allowed to make salt water on Shabbos. You can't make it if you can't make such a high concentration that it would be used for tanning leather. That one is not supposed to do. This becomes an issue when people want to make their salt water for the Seder on Yom Tov. What if Yom Tov is Shabbos? And that's where this becomes a discussion. But he says, if I'm allowed to make salt water, I can mix the water and the salt, even though I'm generating something new. He says, then maybe here I'm also allowed to do this. And he says, I'll bring you another proof. Take a look, please, at source number 15. This is an issue, this source number 15. It comes up in practice regarding ice at the Shabbos table. He says, Hasheleg v'habarad, snow and ice, right? Ein maraskin osam. You would not be allowed to crush snow and ice on Shabbos. Dehainu l'shabram l'chatichos dakos k'neishu yazuvu meimav, meaning breaking them into small pieces so that the water will flow. Avol nosein hu l'toch kos shel yayin omayim. But you could put it in your wine. You could put it in your water. V'unimach me'ela v'veino choshesh. And it'll melt on its own. And there's no concern. So that on Shabbos, if I want ice at the table, I can bring out the ice and put it directly into the drink. That's what he's telling me. He doesn't want me breaking down the ice actively, but the fact that it's going to break down in the drink doesn't concern him. Why is this not a concern? What is the difference between crushing it and allowing it to melt on its own?
Crushing, you're using the hammer.
True. True. Sorry? I'm enhancing it? In what way am I enhancing it? Yeah. In other words, I am aiding the process.
The barrel, the chair, you're actually doing the action, eating it. And here, you're putting it in the water, and what happens afterwards?
Right, so one way to explain this is that, indeed, the key point is whether it is biyadayim or not. Is it being done by hand or not? That's one explanation. And then there's a second explanation, which is the issue of visibility. The Mishnah Berurah says that the reason why you're allowed to melt the ice in your drink is indeed, as you said, because it's happening on its own. I am not, so to speak, wielding the hammer, to go back to that terminology, although this isn't a Makeh Patish case. But I'm not doing it myself. I'm allowing it to happen on its own. That's one point that the Mishnah Berurah makes. But then he adds another point. And this is also relevant for us. He says some permit it, even if you do it actively, if it's mixed into the contents of cup, bowl, receptacle, whatever it is, so that it's not be'en, it's not visible on its own. That's the Mishnah Berurah's second point. Some will permit me to do it actively, even if it's not, they'll permit me to do it actively as long as it's not visible. And based on this, we have a leniency that many do, in fact, employ, to say that I can bring out ice to the table and put it out there on the table and people take or people don't take, as long as there's some liquid in the receptacle, in the bowl that's holding the ice. The idea being that even if it's melting, it's not a visible melting process because there's already liquid there in the bowl. That's the way the argument goes, as recorded in the Mishnah Berurah on that line in Shulchan Aruch, that's in sentence 15. So applying this to us, okay, applying this to our discussion, we were concerned that this might be an issue of molid chom, of generating heat. Did I do it biyadayim? Did I do it by hand? Maybe. I mean, I triggered the chemical reaction. Whether that has to be immediate like makah b'pahadish or not is an interesting question. But I could argue it's not visible. I could argue that it's not visible. Would I be right? Those who were here last week, was it visible or not visible? It was quite visible. The heat itself was not, but its manifestation was. You saw the steam. And you're going to see the steam every time out. You can't do this as a dry reaction. The salt water is a necessary part. So that really, it does seem that this would be considered visible. So Maharsham's leniency regarding the soda water may not really help us here. Frankly, I'm not entirely convinced regarding the soda water either, because frankly, I think it's visible there also. You can see the carbonation. I'm not entirely clear on how that would work. But there's a second reason to be lenient that's far stronger than the first reason. And this is from Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Regarding the issue of creating heat on Shabbos, take a look at source 16. This is a major practical statement. This comes up. It's worth knowing about. If you take a look at source 16, story involving Rabba and Rabbi Zera. Rabba and Rabbi Zera iklu lebei reish galusa. Rabba and Rabbi Zera go to the exilarch's household. The exilarch was the leader of the Jews living in Bavel. He was not necessarily always the greatest Talmid Chacham. It was a political position. Sometimes he was also a Talmid Chacham. Sometimes he wasn't. So look what happens in the exilarch's house. They saw there that a certain servant in the household took a jug of water and put it on the mouth of a kettle. Nazie Rabba. And Rabba rebuked him. Rabba yelled at him. He said, "You can't do that on Shabbos." Shabbos. So Amar Le Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera asks Rabba, "What are you doing? What's the problem? Why is this any different from putting a kettle on top of another kettle? We have leniencies for what we call kedera al gabe kedera, heating the contents of a pot on top of another pot that's itself on a source of heat." So Rabba explained, "There one maintains the heat. Here one creates heat by introducing this item which was cold." On top of the kettle, you are introducing heat into it. That is what we call molid chom. That's the statement of the Gemara, that you have an issue of being molid chom. However, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach commented on this in his Minchas Shlomo, his work of responsa, there are quite a bit of it is devoted to issues related to Shabbos. He said, that's only if you do it at a temperature which would itself cook. It's only if you do it at a temperature that would itself be a high temperature, a temperature for cooking. In other words, it isn't that any time something warms up a little bit, that's called molid chom. It has to be a heat that would actually be a cooking level heat. Now, I think you saw last time, I think I demonstrated, I have to check the video, but I think I demonstrated that the heat on that heating element for these meals is not terribly high. I put my finger down on it. Right? Did I? I think I did. I'm saying no. Go back and check. But I did it at home. That I know. You can put your finger down on it, and you're not going to get burnt. I probably wouldn't leave it there too long. It's uncomfortable. But it's not. It's certainly not a cooking temperature. All it's doing is warming up food that's already pre-cooked. So therefore, the problem of molid chom may well not pertain. It may not have any relevance in this case. The reason I said that discussion is a very important discussion about molid chom and putting something on top of the kettle is because what do you do on Shabbos if you forgot to put on the blech? Are you allowed to put the blech down? That's this issue of molid chom right there, and the answer is maybe not. For all practical things, as I said in the beginning of the first shiur, go to Rabbi Taub. He's the Marad Asra. I get to just give a shiur and leave it to him. But that's certainly something to consider. That's what Shlomo Zalman's reason why molid chom should not be relevant here. There's a third reason why molid should not be considered an issue, which is molid is very, very broad. If this were a discussion of constitutional law, certainly American constitutional law, I don't know anything about Canadian constitutional law, but American constitutional law, you can strike down a law because it's too broad. molid, the way we're defining it, that any time you create some new effect is off limits, is entirely too broad, and we see that it hasn't been legislated that way. So, for example, the Tzitz Eliezer discusses the issue of people who have kidney problems, and the question of whether you can process the urine in order to test it on Shabbos. And he has all sorts of discussions. They have dyes that color things and the like, and he doesn't bring up the issue of the chemical reaction that's involved creating something new in these tests. The molid is discussed in a tshuva by Rav Nachum Rabinovitz, in which he talks about and talks about using a mirror to focus light to create fire, going back to the lens issue. And again, on that issue, there are tshuvos, and no one discusses the problem of molid chom, of generating heat. So the argument is that molid really is far more narrow than we realize. And it shouldn't simply be applied anytime you're going to create a new state, anytime you're going to, generate heat. So to review what we've done, we still have a little more to see, but to review what we've done so far, we reviewed Bishul already from last week, but today we looked at the question of generating a chemical reaction in and of itself being a problem, and concluded that it's not, because we have all sorts of chemical reactions that are discussed in the laws of Shabbos, and no one ever says you can't do it because it's a chemical reaction by nature. We raised the issue of makabe patish. Am I taking the food and making it usable? And that's like generating a finished product, and gave several reasons to be lenient. Makabe patish may not apply to food, according to the Bavli, for example. Another reason was because we said that makabe patish is enduring, and this is not enduring. And then we had a third reason why, and that was because the effect was separate from your action. There was a gap in between. And then we discussed this issue of molid generating heat. And while it seems like there is reason to raise this as a problem, it's defeated potentially by, number one, the fact that number one, it may be defeated by the fact that we have precedent for doing things like creating salt water and not calling it molid is something new. Number two, the fact that the heat that you generate is a very low-level heat. And number three, the fact that we have all sorts of tshuvos about doing things, processing things, and creating chemical reactions that generate a new state, and no one ever discussed molid in all those discussions. There's no reason for us to invent it now. There are a few small problems that may come up regarding these meals in particular, as opposed to all the other chemical reactions. One issue that's discussed, although it's defeated, is the issue of heating the metal itself. Take a look, please, on your sheets. Source 17. One who heats metal in order to temper it in water. Hareza told us Mavir, that's a tolada, a descendant form of kindling a fire. Heating the metal is a descendant form of kindling a fire. The chayiv, and therefore you would be liable. Where did that come into play famously in the last 100 years? Sorry, horseshoes. That wasn't the famous case I was thinking of the last 100 years. This line is a very important line. This is the incandescent light bulb. The reason why incandescent light bulbs were prohibited, the primary reason was this line in the Rambam, which is also brought in Shulchan Aruch. But they had heating metal, because when you have an incandescent bulb, you heat the filament. That's the way it works. And you get it to the point where it glows. So one who heats metal in order to temper it in water has performed a tolda of kindling a fire. That's a form of creating fire. And one is liable. That's another of the issues that's raised regarding putting the blech on the flame on Shabbos. Will you heat up the blech to the point where it actually glows red? Would that could then be a problem of mavir as well? The response, however, in this case, specific to our technology, is that again the heat level just isn't high enough to warrant that. You're not heating this magnesium to the point where it's going to glow. It's just not so. Another potential issue for us to discuss is the issue of nolad, which is a Yom Tov issue. Meaning, on Yom Tov, I'm not allowed to use something. I'm sorry, let me rephrase that so that'll actually be English. If I have something that was generated, created on Yom Tov, I'm not allowed to use it on Yom Tov itself. The classic first Mishnah in Beitza, right? Beitza Shandalda B'Yom Tov. If you have an egg that was laid on Yom Tov, you're not allowed to use it that day. The debate, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, why is it the Gemara goes through that? But if you have something that is nolad, that is created anew on Yom Tov, it's off limits that day. This is separate from a Shabbos consideration. This is a Yom Tov consideration. So would we then decide that this food is considered to be nolad? So the answer is probably not. And the reason we would say probably not is because the food existed beforehand. It was just cold. It's not as though you've really created new food. We're not dealing with the heat issue. We're dealing with the food itself. Another argument that could come up is the issue of hatmana. Hatmana means insulating things or wrapping them. The rule is that I am not allowed to wrap food on Shabbos, even just in order to preserve its heat. If I wrap it entirely, I have a problem. Not if it's cold, obviously. My food that's been sitting out on the table for lunch, I want to put it back in the fridge, I can wrap it up. That's not the problem. So about food that's already hotter than room temperature, and I want to wrap it up to insulate it, I'm not allowed to do that on Shabbos. Before Shabbos, I can wrap it as long as the heat isn't going to go up. As long as I'm not adding heat. Yes? Right. That was what I was using them actually as cooking implements. Here we're talking about scarves that aren't hot to themselves or whatever material I want to use. It's just that the food itself is hot and I want to wrap it up in order to preserve it.
And to put it back in the box. It's cold, it's not hot.
Right, so that's the question. Would this be an issue of hatmana in that I am taking the food and putting it in the box where it is going to heat up? But on the other hand, as you just pointed out, it's cold when I put it in the box. That's the way it works. It's in the box that it's actually going to end up being heated.
You couldn't take it out when it's partially heated to check if it's warm, put it back in the box.
Well, it's even before that. Take a look, please, at the Mishnah Berurah in Source 18. Actually, no, excuse me. That's a different Mishnah Berurah. That's not the one I wanted. That Mishnah Berurah was for a previous source, for the previous discussion. I didn't bring on the sheet the one that I wanted for this. The Mishnah Berurah writes that even if food is cold right now, if I insulate it and then it will become warm, that's a problem for me on Shabbos. So the fact that it's cold right now doesn't help me. The Mishnah Berurah eliminates that. If anyone wants to look it up, it's in Reishon and Zayin 257, number 2, Sipka and Beis. However, there is reason to be lenient on the hatmana issue as well. And the reason to be lenient is because it's not a flush wrapping. In other words, when you wrap something, you wrap it closely. That's not what's happening in that box. The meal goes in, the walls don't couch it tightly. And take a look at Source 19, the line in the Shulchan Aruch. Although one may leave a pot atop a stove with coals inside, in the manner explained above, meaning coals in the stove, if the pot is covered with clothing, even clothes which do not independently add heat, it is prohibited because the fire increases the heat. In other words, I can't leave a pot on top of a stove with clothing, and not clothing specifically, but with insulating materials wrapped around the pot, because the fire is going to increase the heat from below. Right? So think of, for example, the samovar that's wrapped up in stuff. That would be a problem according to this. However, he then says, if the clothing that you're using to insulate the pot does not touch the pot, then it is permitted, even though there is fire below. This is not the manner of insulation. So in other words, putting it back in the box really doesn't generate an insulating scenario. So these smaller issues that we're discussing, smaller in that we're not going into long discussions about them, the issue of heating the metal, the issue of nolad, the issue of hatmana, insulating it, none of these should really be a big issue. So, in practice, what do we do? So again, I'm not poskening, but I will mention to you only that the Kolel Eretz Chemda in Israel addressed this issue in the sixth volume of their work of response of Memari HaBazak, and they went through many of the issues that I discussed here, and ended up saying, you know what? There may be resolutions for a lot of the individual halachic problems, but it seems like there's too much evidence against it, and they recommend not to do it. Rabbi Yisrael Rosen of the Tzomet Institute in Israel said that he believes it's a derabanan to do it. It's a rabbinic prohibition, which we may be lenient with in certain cases of need, particularly because since the food is already cooked, it's a derabanan in any case, as we talked about last week. So that means it's a derabanan on a derabanan, and therefore, let's say this is the only hot food you're going to get for Shabbos, there may be grounds for leniency. But again, as a matter of practice, please ask Rabbi Taub, and he'll guide you. Next week, God willing, we will discuss bionic eyes. That's the topic for next week. We'll probably also merge it with it'll be bionic eyes and web surveillance cameras on Shabbos. Okay, thank you.